Welcome. You are listening to the Better Together podcast with Callie and Rosario Picardo. We take on topics involving marriage, ministry, parenting, communication, relationships, and other subjects that our listeners want to hear more about.
Welcome to another edition of the Better Together podcast. I am your co-host, Rosario Picardo.
And I'm your other co-host, Callie Picardo. And today we have with us Pastor Greg Delaney. Greg is the Senior Community Engagement Specialist with a statewide alcohol and drug treatment center called Woodhaven. But he has taken it beyond that and gotten involved with the state of Ohio with their faith-based recovery advocacy and also started doing that nationwide. Greg, thank you for joining us today on the Better Together podcast.
Oh, I'm so honored. It's just a real pleasure for me. Thank you for inviting me. It's just great. Thanks.
Greg, I call you the godfather of recovery, especially in Dayton, because you are so connected and you're a mover and a shaker in terms of the kingdom of God, which definitely we appreciate. Can you just share your background and what led to the work that you do now and the turning point maybe in your life that set you on this path?
Yeah, sure. I often tell people that, you know, I grew up in the church. I was in church before I was on the planet. There's a picture of me in my mom's belly singing in the choir at their church. And really, you know, my journey was one that, you know, my family was heavily involved in faith and Xenia. My entire family, my parents were singers. They traveled and did singing all over the state in a gospel quartet. And so it was kind of, you know, an expectation that, you know, you just kind of follow that along. If your last name's Delaney, you're going to serve in that space. And then, you know, went to college and had every intention of just being in the business world. Met my wife as she's my high school sweetheart. We met in high school and went to college together, got married. And really, it was pretty uneventful, if you will, unspectacular journey. You know, get the house, the picket fence, the kids, the car, the stuff. But there was a point in time in my life where there was some pressure to succeed that kind of was dormant for a while. And so as my business career kind of got off, it got off to a little bit of a rocky start, got fired from a position. And really, when I look back on it now, you know, deserved to get fired. I was pretty much a jerk when it happened. And but with that, you know, that failure and then the expectations of being what I thought I had to be, being a Delaney, being all of these things. It was in that moment that I had someone kind of offer alcohol as a way to kind of deal with it. And at the moment, it didn't seem all that important. It didn't seem all that significant. But it was when I've been able to look back on it now, it was a moment where I was presented with something that I knew fundamentally, morally, churchily, if that's a word, you just don't do this stuff, right? And yet it provided a level of comfort that I didn't quite expect or really understand. And almost with that first taste of it in that context, sent me on a path that, that I really never would have expected in my life. And that was one of addiction. And what was interesting is early on, the two lives of still being the Delaney in church and being the business guy, I was able to kind of catch the wave of the bubble of IT early on and make a lot of money and, you know, and flew all over the world. And it appeared that, you know, had all of this incredible, you know, success, but with the success came compromise in some of what I believed in, what I grown up with. Found myself in places that, you know, had you asked me when I was 12 or 13, I never would have thought I'd ever be there, because my grandmother would have never tolerated it. My family would have never tolerated it. And there was a ride there for a minute that on the surface seemed really great. You know, I'm making lots of money. I'm flying all over the world, having a lot of success. But with that and that pressure also came a real need to use a lot more alcohol in order to kind of deal with all of it. And then there was the lifestyle that went with it, you know, Las Vegas and Cancun and Europe and all of that. And what I thought I had control over, and what I thought I had kind of compartmentalized, that there was the Greg that was Monday to Saturday, and then there was the Greg that had the expectation on Sunday. When those worlds collided in 2001 with a DUI, it really kind of set in motion, you know, a journey and a spiral that I didn't expect. And as my need for alcohol increased, which it's a progressive illness, we all know that, my success began to wane. They couldn't kind of coexist. Mm-hmm. And there was a point in time where, again, lose another job, retirement, or my kids' college funds, on the lifestyle. I mean, if you had to kind of say, what would a prodigal son look like in, you know, from 2000 to 2008, you know, that would have been on the poster of that. High living, lots of friends, you know, it was all rolling pretty good. But then I got to a place where I started to include other people into my need for, you know, for money. And we bought a business in town. There's a lot to the story. The business failed. It bankrupted not only me, it bankrupted my parents. And it all kind of culminated down to a point in time where, you know, I found myself laying on the couch in the basement of my house, which was actually my parents' house, because we all had to move in together after I bankrupted all of us. There's a lot to that story. But, you know, laying on the couch in my own urine with a bag of wine stuffed between the cushions of the couch, and couldn't even hold a job for $9 an hour cutting vegetables. And so, you know, if you'd asked me when I was, you know, 14 years old, you know, would this be where I would have been at 43? There was no way to predict that. It just didn't seem to add up. It wasn't part of the deal. But at 43, you know, really at that place, and when I have had the chance to look back on it now, you know, there was a lot of things that I was able to uncover in my recovery about trauma, about, for me, the lies that the enemy had continued to tell me, about what was important to me. I found out that I really struggled with affirmation. I really struggled with a lot of things. And as those things went away, consumed by my addiction, you know, it almost doubled down or threw kerosene on the depression and the anxiety and all the stuff that was coming with it. And then the alcohol wasn't fixing it. The alcohol was actually exacerbating it. And so in 2008, you know, came to that catalytic kind of breaking point of, had a good friend, dear friend. He was actually the one who introduced alcohol as a way to kind of cope. He had hanged himself. He had dealt with alcohol use disorder as well. His name was Greg, just like me. He lived down the street, supposed to be at his funeral, and instead woke up that morning of being his pallbearer, and found myself really sick and drove myself to the hospital. Got to the hospital at a 0.4, and really had a moment where I had a near-death experience at that point. And so that's what led into, you know, again, it was not something that anybody could have even predicted, even from high school. I mean, I never even drank in college. But it had come to this place in 2008 where everything around me had fallen apart. All the friends, I mean, again, if you want to take a look at the prodigal, you know, story, the friends were gone. This was my proverbial pig pen, was in the basement of my parents' house. Sad. lonely, still trying to figure out how to pretend that I was okay, but I really wasn't okay. And that led to that particular morning. And if you like, I can go on and talk a little bit about that morning if you want.
I would, you know, what I'm thinking too is, as you're sharing now, we often think of addiction as those people. So, hey, it's street people, it's people from bad families, it's people from bad upbringings. But your story is more common than what others would expect. You grew up in a good household. You were raised in church, white collar job, family. And here you found yourself on the brink.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, when I will go out and share the story, it really should have been in reverse. You know, my wife, Beth, who's now a doctor of nursing practice, and, you know, she's the one that grew up with the father who suffered with alcohol use disorder. She's the kid that grew up in poverty, as you know, under a household that was only, you know, taken care of by a single mom. She's the one with a high ACE score, you know, she's the one with, you know, the daddy that completed suicide in the early 2000s, you know. And so, but it was so different in that, you know, people would say, well, my goodness, she probably would have, you know, she never found substances or found a need to drink to deal with her adversity. And it was just the opposite. As I was really struggling on a spiral coming out of all of those things I shared, exactly what you said, Roz, is that two loving parents, an incredibly supportive community, not wanting for anything, you know, having, you know, great guidance, excellent mentoring all my life, and all the success, you know, the white collar success that you mentioned. And so it was, it is true that now as we work with, you know, folks with substance use disorders and alcohol use disorders and mental health, you know, diagnoses and mental health illness, you know, it's interesting that it really is a non-discriminatory kind of thing. It doesn't really matter. It ends up being somewhat individualistic. It's funny you mentioned that. I was on the phone with a leader at a church of about 2,200 up in the Cleveland area last week. And he's a care pastor, right? And he was sharing his desire to bring some recovery friendly congregational kind of elements to his congregation. And he was describing his demographic as being upper middle class, you know, predominantly, you know, white professional, you know, they're just outside of a real affluent neighborhood. But he made an interesting statement. He said that as a care pastor, he was out with a family who had been a part of the church for 10 years. And the husband had had a stroke. And this will make sense in a second. And so he was there with the wife and the husband. And he was just caring for them in his role. And he said the wife pulled him aside over into the corner of the room where no one else could hear her. And she said, oh, by the way, you know, he's alcoholic too. Mm-hmm. And shame over it. And he's like, I've known you guys for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And no one's ever brought that forward, you know, as to what's going on. And so to your point, Roz, it, you know, when you look at the stats for the state of Ohio, 1 in 13 people have a substance use disorder. 1 in 3 families are being impacted directly or indirectly by one. So when you do that kind of math, it's not us and them. It's just us. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it that way, when we kind of look at it as leaders in the church, big C, you know, we have just as much of an obligation of inreach as we do outreach. Mm-hmm. And how do we create atmospheres and culture that are, you know, accepting, understanding, supportive, empathetic, to where folks don't have to hide and stay in the shadows like that couple where, you know, perhaps there was other ways to minister them prior to the stroke, you know, with what he was dealing with his alcohol. And the good news is that church is going to do some work. We're going to head up there at the, you know, in the middle of March, but, you know, that part is so true. And the work that you folks do within Mosaic, and, you know, when I was there the other day, you realize it. You look at that group and it is us. Mm-hmm. And it is a whole, you know, you've created such a beautiful and diverse landscape for people to get better. They're comfortable there. And there's a lot to be said for that, because you've always embraced it that it's us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so when, so going back to your question, you know, looking at, yeah, I mean, how do you get there? You know, and it's interesting too, that my friend Greg, who we, you know, we lost to this disease back in 2008. You know, Greg was similar, you know, everything, great parents, successful school guys, successful in college, successful in state government. But the pressures and the correlation of pressure and stress and the immediate relief that alcohol lies and tells you that it brings, you know, eventually became his undoing. So, you know, yeah.
Well, Greg, take us to that morning, that encounter, or, you know, we're on the cliffhanger.
I know.
Our listeners are on the cliff.
Did Jesus interact? Did he come into the scene?
Yeah, yeah, he really did, in a very interesting and weird way. But a way that, you know, it's so on that morning, you know, I made a phone call to Beth. I was sitting in a McDonald's parking lot throwing up blood, and I got in the car and I called her and I said, I got to go to the hospital. And she said she really didn't care. You know, and there's a lot to her story that really would be a good one for y'all to have, yeah. Because what the Lord had shown her through the journey of my substance use, and then the work that she did, is a great example of what families can do to support, but also to have boundary and guardrail and know when, you know, when to say enough is enough. And I've, you know, got to kind of take care of me. Then so she said, you know, I really don't care if you go or not. She had done this, you know, I'd been to detox 13, 14 times. I've been to rehab already. So she thought it's just another one of the, you know, failed attempts. And so I get in the car, I drive to Miami Valley Hospital. Again, I'd done this a lot of times. And so the routine was pretty familiar. Handed my license, handed my insurance card. I'm going to go on the telemetry floor. They're going to do a CWID test, a special test for me. They're going to flush all the ammonia in my system. They're going to give me vitamins. I'm going to have a break from the alcohol for 2 or 3 days. I'm going to get rehydrated and I'll go back to doing what I do. And my week prior to going into the hospital was comprised of a 9-day bender where I only drank vodka and wine and ate Jolly Rancher candy. And so I lost track of how much I'd been drinking, and my body, my liver had really started to feel the effects of it. And I got a cold and my liver couldn't keep up. And so I was septic, and I didn't know that. And so I was about the same color. When I do my talk, I talk about SpongeBob. And so I was the same color as SpongeBob. My blood pressure went to 70 over 40. My pulse went to 194, 195. And, I was going to die. And my wife was the palliative care director at Miami Valley Hospital at that time. And so she daily would be in the ICU spending time with families on end of life issues. What we're going to do, how to work through that. So she got a call from her trusted guys that she works with every day. And they said, you need to come downstairs. And she went down, they pulled the curtain back and they said, we think we should resuscitate him at least once. What do you think? Hmm. And all of this that she tells in her part of the story is that it comes flooding to her that, you know, here's a guy that has lost everything with his illness. He's ruined our family. We've been bankrupted. Things that aren't often told in the story is in our bankruptcy. My wife lost her entire retirement, 20 years of working. They flushed her entire 403B. We had lost our home. My kids had lost all of their furniture to auction. You know, my parents had lost their retirement because they invested in the business with me. I had spent probably a better portion of our money, you know, in strip clubs and just awful, you know, decisions. And then yet in that moment, she would say that she leaned over to her friends and she said, take care of him. I trust you. And then she went off into the corner of the hospital room or the ICU and said, you know, God, he's tormented by this illness. If you want him, I'm good. Mm-hmm. You can have him. I know he accepted you at 13. I'm good. Mm-hmm. And then she was so good that she had actually coordinated with one of my dear friends to raise my children if I didn't make it. Mm-hmm. So she had already done her work. And but she said, if you leave him here, will you please heal him? Mm-hmm. And so I figured out what it was. I had a terrible infection. My liver wasn't working. And they took the necessary intervention. Obviously, I'm talking to y'all. So, but when you talk about the moment, the catalytic moment, it was 3 days later. And when I woke up in the hospital, there was a pastor from a church in Xenia that I knew him a little. I didn't like him. I didn't respect him. He was from the Pentecostal church in town. I was a Church of Christ boy. We didn't talk to Pentecostal people.
Right.
You know, that whole thing, right? And he's sitting across from me, and his name's Mark Brooks. And I'm like, man, why are you here? I was even angry about the fact that he was in my room. He was, because of the hypocrisy that I thought he embodied. You know, he had a reputation and blah, blah, blah. And so still being that judgmental, absolute jerk that I had become pretty much throughout the whole journey. And so he sat there with me and calmly looked at me and he said, I'm here because the Lord told me you're going to be my recovery pastor.
Hmm.
And I'm like, you're out of your mind, bro. I'm a drunk. A, there's no way that's going to happen. B, it can't happen in a Pentecostal church. There's no way that's going to happen. And he said, no. He said, this is, and to his credit, he handed me the keys to the church. And he said, we got these guys that meet on Monday night. And I want you to start meeting with them. And this is what I think we're going to do together. And he walked with me for a year. I followed a pretty strong program, both, you know, AA and faith-based recovery for a year. I was under a significant amount of scrutiny for a year. I had to go on disability for a year. Mark made me a part of the staff, just enough so I wouldn't mess up my disability. Mm-hmm. And I found a different path and a different journey, and the Lord came in. And what's crazy about the thing is everything that I had done in business, everything that I had done in the IT infrastructure, were all skills that now I have to have to do what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in all of that mess and sin and everything that surrounded that part of my life, that chapter in life, hadn't gone to waste. What the enemy really wanted to use to kill me, God has now turned it into something good. And so Mark stayed with me. Mark was, you know, I don't tell this part of the story much. I used to plan a golf trip with a group of really good friends every year, and it was just an excuse to drink. And when I was sick in the hospital, that group had grown to about 28 guys, I think, was the last time we went. And when I was in the hospital, I didn't have one of them visit me.
Mm.
And not because they didn't love me. Many of them didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then we've talked about it afterwards, but several of them were those friends that they were the friends along for the party, not for the relationship. And I love them, and there's no bitterness there. But so what happened was, is after that year, you know, our freedom gathering grew, was what we called it at AHOP. We started to, you know, go from 7 folks to 20 to, you know, at Zenith, when I was in, you know, when I was leading it, you know, we were up in the hundreds of folks coming to have recovery. And, but what was amazing about what Mark did was that, he stayed along my side and gave me vision for the future. And I think if there's anything that I would want someone to always hear from the story is, you know, we have a lot of folks that have gotten better due to consequence. That's true. Folks go to jail, they find Jesus, they go on to have amazing stories. But for me, it was somebody painting what could be the future.
Mm.
And I think one of the one of the things that you know has led me to do what I do today, you know, why I'm in Columbus today, it's how do we continue to provide opportunities and present a vision of the future for the people that, you know, for the us that we talked about at the beginning, that we get a chance to encounter, that if they felt like I did on that day in 2008, that it's hopeless, everybody that you beat up, burned up, abandoned, everybody that cares about you, the number one relationship in your life is, pardon me, for me, it was liquor. It wasn't my kids. It wasn't my wife. It was what liquor could do for me and what liquor was doing to me, but what liquor could do. And that was the most important relationship in my life. And when you're there, there just seems to be no hope.
Yeah.
When you're there, and I probably would have been okay. I've had people ask, did you get sober because you were going to die? And I said, no, I got sober because somebody said I could live.
Yeah.
And because I had lots of people tell me I was going to die. Dr. Al Samkari, an addictionologist in Miami Valley Hospital, on multiple occasions would walk into my hospital room on any number of times when I was in the hospital and say, you know, Greg, if you continue to drink, you're going to die. And I'm like, I don't care. If I don't drink, I'm going to die. That's the way it felt.
You've heard Greg's story, at least part of it, and join in next week as he dives in a bit more of how God is using him in ways that he would have never expected.
Thank you for that encouraging word today. And friends, if this has blessed you, I pray that you will share it with someone else and that you'll just say yes to God. Sit with God for a little while and say, God, what do you have for me in this season? Until next time, remember, we are better together. God bless.